20. Fonzie Mania. Henry, Donnie, Anson, and I were fast friends. Four guys who had not previously known one another, apart from my filming the earlier pilot with Anson, discovered that they were simpatico not only on the set, but off the lot. On Monday nights, Cheryl and I took to dining out with Henry. It was our way of socializing and trying out new restaurants on a quiet night. Already, weekend dining was a non-starter because our newfound popularity precluded us from getting through a meal unhassled by throngs of fans. Henry called us the Monday Marauders. As time went on, our group expanded to include his girlfriend and future wife, Stacy Weitzman, and when Three's Company became a hit on ABC, John Ritter and his wife, Nancy Morgan. Donnie gamely agreed to play the lead in a naturalistic indie movie that I was making on weekends. It was called Leo and Lori. I was trying to emulate the improvisational style of John Cassavetes. Donnie was Leo. Lori was played by Linda Pearl, who Happy Days fans know as Richie's girlfriend Gloria in the show's first season, and Fonzie's steady Ashley in the later seasons. I never finished the film, though it was later reshot by Jerry Paris, Happy Days' main director, and received a limited release through United Artists. As for Anson, he and I hatched plans to produce films together. Eventually, we actually made one, a TV movie called Skyward. So, from an interpersonal standpoint, Happy Days was a terrific place to work. I couldn't have asked for a better group of colleagues. If The Andy Griffith Show was my de facto hometown, where I felt safe among the set's kindly grown-ups, Happy Days was college and the Army rolled into one, where I met my once and forever confidants and drinking buddies. Not that I've ever been much of a drinker. An added benefit to working on the show, the early 1970s were a cool time to be on the Paramount lot. In my wanderings, I happened upon a private advance screening of Roman Polanski's next film, Chinatown, and was waved in to catch it before it hit the theaters. I caught glimpses of Francis Ford Coppola, who was busy putting the final touches on The Godfather Part II. I felt the same electric excitement in these moments that I had experienced while making American Graffiti. The next wave of American culture was upon us, and I was surfing it in real time. I needed this boost because Happy Days was wearing me down physically and mentally. Initially, it was a single camera rather than three camera show. This means that it was shot more like a feature film with no studio audience and each scene's various angles and takes captured by the same camera. It's a laborious way to work that requires long days with hardly a break between camera setups, and I was in nearly every scene of Happy Days. This was gratifying, but I was also still trying to carry a course load at USC while coaching Clint's intermediate-level baseball team. To better situate myself for this peripatetic way of life, I moved out of my dorm and rented an apartment in Glendale. I was clueless about how to live as an adult. My cupboard contained nothing but boxes of Wheat Thins. When I got home from work, I ate a half a box for dinner. What remained of my free time was spent working on scripts and, of course, being with Cheryl. I was stressed to the hilt, completely running on fumes. But the biggest stressor of all was Fonzie. Not Henry, but Fonzie. It did not escape my notice that as the season went on, the Fonz was getting more and more screen time. I had perceived Fonzie Mania to be an outside force, a phenomenon generated by the fans. Now I was becoming suspicious. It almost seemed as if the network was trying to marginalize me on my own show. Could this be true? No, I can't be. I'm imagining it. I didn't handle my stress particularly well. I probably would have benefited from seeing a psychotherapist, but we Howards were stoic Oklahomans who didn't have any history with that sort of thing. Instead, I kept everything inside. Then I started breaking out in eczema rashes all over my body, most acutely on my eyelids, which stung with itchiness. I took to calling this condition stress eye, and my hair started thinning. Looking at the men on both sides of my family, I knew it was inevitable that I would not hang on to my hair forever. but it started coming out in alarming clumps during this time. Whether or not this was caused by my feelings of overload, it certainly contributed to my unease. To top things off, Happy Days, to everyone's surprise, was floundering in its second season. Rather than building on the momentum of our debut season, we slipped precipitously, finishing at number 49 in the Nielsen ratings. This was partly attributable to the sitcom Good Times, a Maud spinoff in its second year. In 1974, CBS's hard-charging head of entertainment, Fred Silverman, moved Good Times from Fridays to Tuesdays so that it could go head-to-head with Happy Days. What we had done to Maud in the previous season was now being done to us. Silverman's revenge. Like Happy Days, Good Times was a breakout mid-season hit with a breakout star. While we had Henry as the Fonz, whose catchphrase was, "A," Good Times had Jimmy Walker as J.J. Evans, whose catchphrase was, "Dynamite." Unlike Fonzie, who was still a supporting character, J.J. was front and center in Good Times. His dynamite was heard with more frequency than our show's A. Walker was having a major cultural impact. It was a wake-up call when Dynamite demolished us in the ratings. We needed to up our game. As our second season neared its end, ABC decided to conduct an experiment. We temporarily became a three-camera show, with an open stage-like set and a live studio audience. The three cameras maneuver around within a pit area in front of the set, capturing the action from three different angles simultaneously. Gary Marshall brought in a hotshot young writing duo from The Odd Couple, Lowell Ganz and Mark Rothman, to write a special episode for the occasion. It was centered around, guess who? Fonzie. In this episode, Fonzie, the consummate ladies' man, shocks Richie, Potsy, and Ralph by telling them that he's getting married. But when he and his bride-to-be come to the Cunningham's house for dinner, Howard Cunningham recognizes the Fonz's fiancée. Far from being the virtuous librarian Fonzie believes her to be, she is a burlesque show stripper who Mr. Cunningham remembers as the entertainment at a hardware convention that he attended in Chicago. At episode's end, the engagement is sundered and the Fonz, to the relief of every girl in America, remains single. In our cast, I was the absolute neophyte in terms of working in front of an audience. Apart from those low-stress county fair appearances with Andy and Don and one little summer stock play that I did with my dad up in Shasta Lake, California when I was 8, I had not performed in front of living, breathing spectators. I had become accustomed to the safety net of the second take. Now I had to memorize and rehearse every scene with the expectation that I would nail it in one pass, with strangers watching. It was a daunting prospect, especially given that all the other principals in Happy Days had theater experience. I almost threw up before we started filming, but Henry, Marion, Tom, and our show's director, Jerry Paris, worked with me all week, teaching me how to play to an audience. Once we were rolling, I found my rhythm and acquitted myself well. Still, if you watch the episode Fonzie's Getting Married, you can see how pale and clammy I am from nerves. When we were done, though, I was exhilarated. I loved feeding off the audience's energy and getting real laughs instead of anticipating the spots where the laugh track would be dropped in. ABC liked what it saw, and Happy Days was renewed for a third season, on the condition that it was now going to be a three-camera show with a studio audience. I was creatively excited by this development, but I wasn't prepared for the other big change they had in store. Fred Silverman had recently been lured from CBS to ABC. Our old tormentor was our new boss. In this capacity, Silverman was keen to do to Good Times what he and Good Times had done to Happy Days just a year earlier. As he put it with characteristic bluster, "I think Fonzie can knock J.J. out." Fonzie, not Richie or Potsy or Ralph. That didn't upset me, though. What shook me to my core was when I was notified that the network was planning on changing the name of our show. They were now going to call it Fonzie's Happy Days. Nope, I wasn't imagining it. I was being marginalized by my own show. In moments of crisis, you assess. You take stock and figure out what really matters to you. When I did this, I realized that what mattered to me most were directing, my family, and above all, Cheryl. Though I proclaimed my love for her within weeks of our first date, Cheryl was slower to make a definitive declaration, or maybe she was just more sensible than I was. In our first year together, when I ventured an I love you, she responded, "I really like you, but I don't think I can love you yet." A few months later, we had graduated to Cheryl saying, "I think I might love you." Once we'd been together a year, I tried it again. We were making out in the VW Bug. "I love you," I said. "I love you too," she responded. Not a proactive declaration, but she said the words. "I've known that for a long time," I said. We played out a similar process in terms of agreeing to get married. I popped the question after a fashion when we were still in high school, saying, "I think we should get married." She politely put me off, telling me it was way too early to talk about stuff like that. I tried again a couple of years later when she was at Valley College. Didn't get on bended knee, just floated the idea. "What if we..." She cut me off. She told me she needed to focus on getting her credits so she could transfer to Cal State Northridge. By the spring of 1975, we had both turned 21. Cheryl had successfully transferred, so that was no longer a card she could play. And the chaotic boy band-like scenes that I had experienced doing promo for Happy Days drove home how much I truly loved her. Being on the road presented all manner of opportunities for casual flirtations, which I indulged, and casual sex, which I avoided. There was no one else I wanted. Still, I was only 21. My parents had gotten married young, but this was a different era. I was momentarily paralyzed with self-doubt, so I presented my dilemma to Anson. "Cheryl is the one for me, but I don't know," I said. Do you think I should get married?" Anson had been my partner on the road. He had partaken in the opportunities that came his way while I moped in my hotel room, pining for Cheryl. He couldn't help but laugh. "Howard, you're married already," he said. "What are you waiting for?" Thus emboldened, I resolved to propose again. I never really thought it out. We were simply driving to a movie, both of us in casual clothes. Smooth guy that I was, I chose a moment when we were on an on-ramp to the Ventura Freeway to say, "Do you want to get married?" "Really?" said Cheryl. In my peripheral vision, I could see that she was smiling. Yeah, I've been really thinking about it," I said. "I think it's time. So, do you want to get married?" "Okay," she said tentatively. We drove, smiling in silence, for a few minutes. Then Cheryl piped up. "Does this mean we're engaged, Ron?" "Yeah, I think that's what it means." "Okay," she replied. It was probably the most romantic proposal and acceptance ever to take place on a Southern California on-ramp. We decided to bag the movie. Instead, we turned around and headed back to my place in Glendale, where we made love. Our wedding took place on June 7, 1975. We were married at Magnolia Park United Methodist Church in Burbank. The officiant was a man named Bobs Watson. Bobs was a former child actor who had appeared with Spencer Tracy and Mickey Rooney in the 1938 movie Boys Town, and then in adulthood became an ordained Methodist minister. The resonance of being married by a former child actor was too good not to take advantage of. Mom and Dad didn't understand our hurry to get married, but they were by then fans of Cheryl and understood that our love was real. and they knew they had no standing to raise objections to getting married at a young age. They were Exhibit A of its benefits. Ours was as low budget and rudimentary a wedding as you could ever picture. The total cost was $800, including the price of Cheryl's dress. We had no reception, just a simple ceremony followed by cake and non-alcoholic punch in the church's courtyard. Cheryl and I hung around for 20 minutes to pose for pictures and cut the cake before a smaller group of friends and family migrated to my parents' house in Toluca Lake, 5 minutes away. Mom had made champagne punch and put up some helium balloons. That was it. Aunt Julia, now in a wheelchair, came all the way from Duncan, her hair as blue and tall as ever. Granddad Beckenholt, my last surviving grandparent, did not make the trip, but he had given our union his blessing the previous Christmas. As a surprise to Dad, Clint and I had pooled some of our money to secretly fly Granddad out, his first and only trip to California, which he very reluctantly signed on for. We built up the suspense to Dad like the actors we were. "Your Christmas present this year, Dad, you won't believe it," we kept saying. "It's going to blow your mind." "What is it?" Dad asked. "Oh, it's big," I said, "but it'll fit. You'll appreciate it." I was playing chess with Dad by the fireplace when Clint returned from the airport with our guest in tow. Granddad wore an old sport coat and a dress shirt buttoned to the collar, a farmer dressed for church. He walked in and silently shook Dad's hand. It was the only time that I ever saw Dad stunned and at a loss for words. As reticent as Granddad was, he was taken with our setup on Clybourne Avenue. About half an hour into his visit, having had a look around at the four bedrooms, the living room, the dining room, the den, and the spacious yard, he said, "Well, Harold, it looks like the show business has been pretty good to you after all." It was the biggest affirmation that Dad ever got from his father. Of equal importance to me, Granddad was really impressed by Cheryl. Before he flew back to Kansas, he took me aside and said, "Seems to me a feller like you probably ought to go ahead and wind up marrying a girl like that." My groomsmen were three of my Cordova Street buddies, Noel, John, and Bob, plus Anson, Donnie, and Charlie Martin Smith. Our matching rented tuxedos were the apotheosis of mid-1970s men's fashion, wide-lapelled and powder blue, with ruffled tux shirts in the same color. All us guys sincerely thought that we looked incredibly cool. At least Cheryl looked timelessly beautiful in her traditional white wedding dress with a flowing train. The only reason Henry wasn't officially in the wedding party was because he was away on location filming a TV movie. He implored the production to let him hop on a plane to attend the ceremony. He arrived early with a George Harrison mustache and hair down to his collar, and we put him to work as an additional usher. The network's machinations and favoritism had done nothing to strain our friendship. Andy Griffith and Don Knotts also came, which moved me no end. I no longer saw much of them, but like the de facto family that they were, they showed up when it mattered. So too did People Magazine, which dispatched a reporter and a photographer to the church. They must have been baffled by our completely unglamorous affair, but to their credit, they were respectful. The getaway car was driven by my best man, 16-year-old Clint. He was charged with driving the very grown-up new vehicle that Cheryl and I had bought together, a boxy maroon Volvo 240 station wagon. My groomsmen decked it out with the traditional accoutrements, streamers, tin cans dragging from the back, and a Just Married placard. I was a little worried about being driven by Clint that day. He couldn't stop giggling and burned rubber the whole way. Fortunately, it was a short drive and we all got there fine, but I suspect he was high.
"Yes, I was high. I took a couple of pipe loads before the festivities kicked off, and as far as I was concerned, I was going to be perfectly fine behind the wheel." By age 16, I had fully integrated marijuana into my life. I was smoking weed morning, noon, and night. It was so damn accessible through my classmates who were dealers. One played on the borough's football team, and another was the most popular guy in auto shop. I could score a four-finger bag of Colombian for $30 or $40, and that would hold me for a couple of weeks. Ron, living as he did in Glendale, was oblivious to how much I was smoking. But Dad was starting to get the picture. I had gotten into trouble a couple of years earlier when I helped myself to a couple of cigarettes from a pack that Mom had left lying around. I didn't particularly like them, but my curiosity had gotten the better of me. Dad smelled the smoke on my clothes and lost it. He didn't want me to experience the same health issues as Mom. I got the hardest spanking of my life. Dad could still get away with that when I was 13 or 14, but by my mid-teens, I wasn't going to take it. It's just sort of hardwired into a boy's DNA that at a certain age, he feels like he's ready or even eager to tangle with his old man. So when he challenged me about my pot smoking one day, around the time that Ron and Cheryl got married, I challenged him right back. It started with him telling me that he could smell it on me. He called me a dopehead. He said the word dope with disgust. He was from that generation that had no problem with alcohol, but believed marijuana to be morally beyond the pale. I made the case that this was hypocritical. I saw no categorical difference between booze and pot. With no small measure of bravado, I said, "You should try it, Pop. You might actually enjoy it." Dad was too tough to act shocked. He gave as good as he got. "You know, maybe I will. Maybe I will try it." So I went upstairs to get my bong. "Come on, Pop," I said when I came back down. "Let me see you do it. Do a bong load. You're going to love it." I was provoking him, but I was also sincere. I thought if he just took a hit, he would enjoy it and see the error of his ways. I miscalculated. I had never seen him so angry. "Dope won't get you anywhere. Get that out of my sight," he said. "I don't want that shit in my house." I didn't quite sense that his fists were balling up in preparation to give me a pummeling, but this was definitely an escalation. If I hung around, there was a chance that things could get ugly, so I just bolted. I ran out the door and spent a few hours at a friend's house, allowing time for the tension to diffuse. When I returned, the bong was still there. He hadn't smashed it up like a southern sheriff demolishing a moonshiner's still. He chose to remain my loving, supportive dad. But now I knew that he knew. At this stage of my life, weed wasn't getting in the way of things at school. To the contrary, I was a pitcher on the varsity baseball team and a dedicated correspondent and photographer for the Burroughs High newspaper, The Smoke Signal.
Burroughs sports teams were all called the Indians, and the Smoke Signal was an extension of that. This was a good three decades before schools, leagues, and other institutions began to realize how offensive these culturally exploitative names were. The girls in the cheerleading and twirling corps, Cheryl among them, were known as the Injunettes. Some of them wore feathered headdresses. That name is no longer in use, and the community is currently debating whether or not to retire the Indian's name.
The journalism supervisor for the Smoke Signal was a brilliant woman named Betty Trimpe. Ron had thrived under Mrs. Trimpe, so she was already well-disposed toward me when I reached high school. I loved her intellect and attitude. She didn't shy away from letting us do controversial stories that might ruffle the administration. My friend, Gig Kariakou, and I pushed for a special issue of the paper devoted to teen smoking, complete with a magazine-style photographic cover. She was on board. Competition was always a part of my student journalism career. In junior high, Gig and I won national recognition in a Columbia University competition. We wrote a feature article on the Jordan Middle School alum Rene Rousseau's inspiring trajectory from bullied outcast to fashion model on the cover of Vogue. Later on, she became a successful actress, starring in Ron's Ransom, among other movies. Rene graciously gave us an interview, and I turned it into a strong piece. I had a knack for writing, and I enjoyed it. At Burroughs, I started working for the Smoke Signal as a sophomore. In 1976, my junior year, Mrs. Trimpe entered her selections of the paper's best work into a journalism contest held by Pepperdine University. The college, located in Malibu, hosted dozens of California high schools in the day-long event. I was the paper sports editor that year and won Pepperdine's top prize in page design. The award came with a special prize, automatic admission to the university, and 1 year's paid tuition. Talk about a sweet deal. Pepperdine had a great communications program and an even better setting, on a hill overlooking the blue Pacific. Just like that, I didn't have to worry about the grueling 2-minute drill that most of my comrades were dealing with to get into a college. I could just cruise through my senior year. That felt great, but I was still laid low by other aspects of my life. No girlfriend, not much in the way of acting work, the hormonal swings of ongoing adolescence. I simply didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. So I anesthetized myself with weed, which made me feel comfortably numb, like the song says. In fact, my high school journalism career facilitated my ability to do this. If you worked on the school paper, you were given a ton of autonomy to roam free on assignment. You could even pick up a gas voucher or two. There were days when I spent only 2 periods in a classroom, and most of the time getting high. Me and my stoner buddies called this doing the summertime Gumby. But anyone who is keeping himself numb for that long, for that much of the day, is postponing a reckoning. Because while you're ignoring your bad feelings, all manner of shit is building up inside of you. And at some point, it's gonna come out. Eventually, it did.
So what did I think about ABC's suggestion to rename our show Fonzie's Happy Days? First off, I thought it was a desperately gimmicky attempt to cash in on the character that Henry had created, and I believed that the move would be viewed as cheesy. I was also incredibly insulted. My parents, normally calm, sage dispensers of guidance, could offer no help in this predicament. Mom was simply outraged at the network. Dad had no ready advice. He understood hard work, quality storytelling, and not letting the business side of things wreck one's love for acting and creating. But I also recognized that in his mind, mine was a quality problem to have. Hell, I was still going to be the lead straight man on a popular TV show. He would have killed for that himself. Dad was also not a hardball-playing show business tactician. The way he saw it, I had signed a contract. My deal had nothing to do with the title of the show. No one was asking me to relinquish my top billing, and I had no enforceable say in the matter. I can't blame them for this, but Mom and Dad had no way of grasping the emotional toll of this situation, or for that matter, the true depth of my passion for chasing my primary dream of becoming a filmmaker. I was a young adult, but an adult nonetheless. These pivotal decisions were now mine to make. I kept my cool and tried to view the Fonzie's Happy Days situation as an omen. Maybe this lousy turn of events was actually an opportunity. I decided to tell the network brass that if this title change was what they wanted, I was happy to go back to film school. I had pulled out of USC during my sophomore year once I realized how busy the show was keeping me, how exhausted I was, and how little I was taking advantage of my precious slot at a great college. I wasn't learning enough in the measly amount of time that I spent on campus, and I kept having to drop classes. I didn't completely give up on school. I took 2 night classes at Valley College, where Cheryl had gone, in world history and business law to keep my mind sharp. But hey, if ABC was turning Happy Days into the Fonzie show, I was ready to apply for reinstatement at USC. 2 of Happy Days' executive producers, Tom Miller and Ed Milkus, asked me to come in for a meeting on the Paramount lot. They weren't corporate hatchet men. Tom, in fact, was someone I considered a friend. He had worked as a young man for the great director, Billy Wilder, and happily obliged me when I pestered him for behind-the-scenes stories about Some Like It Hot and the apartment. But they were the ones deputized to handle my situation. Tom cut to the chase. Ron, Fred Silverman wants to pour a lot more money into the show, and he wants the audience to know that it's a fresh version of what we've been doing. So he is very committed to adding Fonzie to the show's title. After a period of uncomfortable silence, I collected myself and mustered a response. I think you both know that I didn't leave film school to be in someone else's show. Well, your billing wouldn't change, Tom said. And by the way, if you agree to this, I know that the network would be open to improving your episode fee. Money wasn't really the issue, though. My concerns were, A, that this was a transparent exploitation of what Henry and the writers had organically developed, and B, the title change would represent a very public demotion for me. Look, I love what Henry is doing, and I don't want to limit the way Gary and the writers are developing the episodes. But if you're changing the title, then I would prefer to leave the show and go back to USC. Tom tried another tack. If you had a choice between being the next Paul Newman or the next Francis Coppola, which would you choose? Coppola, I said. Well, we could arrange for you to direct an episode every year, Ron, Tom said. That would be a great jumping-off place for you. This didn't interest me. Thanks, but the whole point is that Jerry Paris is so good at his job, I said. His episodes are head and shoulders above the ones where we have guest directors. I feel the difference when someone else is directing, and I wouldn't want to put the other actors through that. What I didn't say was that even Jerry had the occasional clunker. It happens in the unforgiving grind of series television, and what if my one episode totally sucked? Then Hollywood's view of me would be, why hire that loser? He can't even direct his own show. Will you at least think about it, Ron? Tom said. Talk to your agent. Talk to your folks. And let us know by tomorrow. I got up and politely said goodbye to Tom and Ed. As I exited their offices, Gary surprised me. He had been hovering outside the whole time. He asked me what I thought of ABC's idea and their offer. I told him bluntly. He paused for a moment, and then said that if I didn't support the title change, he, as the creator of the program, would never allow it. End of story. So the title of the show remained Happy Days. Richie Cunningham returned for the third season. The issue never came up again. In a way, this incident served me well, in that I was reminded, as I had been after the Andy Griffith show, that the entertainment industry had no investment in my well-being. It's a cold business, and no one in Hollywood felt sentimentally obligated to advance my career and keep me happy. I also came to grips with the idea that even if Happy Days ran for years, I needed an exit plan. Sitcom stardom was a gilded cage for most actors, rarely a springboard to better things. In a couple of years, Welcome Back Cotter's John Travolta would defy this trend and become a major movie star, and Robin Williams, whose show Mork and Mindy began its life as a Happy Days spinoff, would follow suit a few years after that. But they were still outliers, exceptions to the rule. When we started the third season, Gary approached me. You know, Ron, I go to a shrink sometimes, he said. I talk to him about what you're going through. He said something smart, and I'm going to pass it along to you. It's what Nietzsche wrote. What does not kill me makes me stronger. You'll come out of this a stronger person. Gary and Nietzsche were absolutely right. I still regard Gary as the most remarkable leader and manager of talent that I have ever known. He was a natural teacher and a man of many adages, his favorite being, life is more important than show business. Time and again, he gave us all lessons in how to abide by that motto. For a few weeks, my mind was clouded by revenge scenarios. How would I ever get back at ABC and Fred Silverman? But as my nerves settled, I decided upon a more constructive strategy, undeniable achievement. I started to take concrete steps to determine how I might make my first full-length feature film, who would finance it, who would give me the green light to make it. With some of my Happy Days money, I splurged on a yellow Volkswagen pop-top camper, a version of the famous VW bus whose retractable roof came with a tent attachment and a cot, creating a nice little loft space. This was going to be the vehicle that I would use when Cheryl and I took to the road to make independent films, sleeping upstairs. I went to the DMV to get a special vanity plate for the bus. It had the word film on it, but with four M's. Film.